well on your daughter. Show the association that you are an asset to her and not an anchor. I would be willing to reflect that in my attitude on the topic, which is not without weight in certain circles.
Even after she turned on your friend?
She only tried to hurt his interests, not him, Rufus said. Where I come from, politics are a fact of life. Since she is going to continue as director, my preference would be that she's an effective one. Her plan is still in play, if she wants it to be.
What plan is that?
To get promoted out of this town by cleaning it up. An appropriate show of contrition and using the inquiry as a launching pad would at least give her a chance. The city service agreement is 2 years from renegotiation. 2 years is a long time in politics.
So it is, Dorgan mused. If I agree to help you, I can't just wave my hand and produce all the city's smugglers. I can use my connections here and in Hornis, but there are complications. Clarissa Ventress and Cole Silver control no small portion of the less documented aspects of city trade, and there are some operators whom none of us tolerate and who are forced to work around us. There are things even the worst of us will not allow to be traded.
I find that hard to believe, Rufus said.
Mr. Remore, I am more government official than criminal. The powers ruling this island would let Old City fall into chaos so long as the money flows. I'll acknowledge that I have walked hard roads, but I have my standards.
What about the other two, Ventress and Silver?
Ventress knows her limits, or at least she used to. If anyone is working with those I won't tolerate, it will be Cole Silver. He's impulsive, short-sighted, and repulsive enough to traffic with those his father would have hunted down.
I'd pay him a visit, Rufus said, but that would send the ones I'm after scurrying into the shadows.
I will make some circumspect inquiries, Dorgan said. I will expect your support for my daughter in turn.
Your daughter's best move is to do her job right, in the open, where people can see her do it. I'd be happy to help that along.
Very well, Dorgan said. You have secured my help, Mr. Remore. I will find you when I have something.
Chapter 18. What the Geller Name is Worth. Rick led Clive and Belinda through the grounds. Clive and Belinda were both enraptured as Rick took them through pathways off the main thoroughfares, the visitors rapidly talking.
"See that flowering vine?"
Clive asked, pointing it out to Belinda.
"See the way they have it growing over the bamboo frame?"
"That's floating ghost flower, right?"
Belinda asked.
"Good eye," Clive said.
"I know a guy who grows it."
"An apothecary?"
"More of a recreational enthusiast."
Clive stopped under an archway, covered in the flowering vine, making sweeping gestures with his arms.
"If you could see magic, you'd be able to spot the subtle impact the landscaping has on the ambient magic over the whole estate. Whoever designed this place was a genius. The foresight to wait for plants to grow over decades, planning out the shifts in magic as plants and trees grew, adapting for seasonal changes, different stages of growth.
I can't imagine planning that out over the whole space," Belinda said. "This estate is bigger than an entire district in Old City."
"We should probably keep moving," Rick prompted. His cousin, Henry, was the team magic expert and had been similarly impressed by the grounds when they first arrived. Now Henry's ashes had been mixed into the soil. They spotted the dome of the Mirage Chamber well before they reached the annexed buildings attached to it. Rick unlocked the control room to the Mirage Chamber and led them inside. Light from the glass ceiling lit up the interior, showing the wooden platforms lining the sides of the room and the waist-high stone block under the wide window that crossed the entire back wall. The interior of the dome beyond was dark. Clive immediately began explaining things to Belinda, who had never seen anything from this branch of magic.
"These wooden platforms are the interface," he explained. It projects your senses into an illusionary self that can interact with other generated illusions in the dome on the other side of that window.
He walked up to the stone block. It was heavy and grey, with a wild mess of runes and sigils carved into it.
"These are the controls," Clive said. "It's a lot more impressive when the chamber is active, which you'll see later."
Clive pointed out a small hole on the side of the block.
"That's where you feed the crystals, containing the various things to be replicated under the dome," he explained. "The chamber's current configuration is fine to generate some environments with some monsters in them. It's a bit basic to handle what we brought along, though. Still, just building a mirage chamber in an area of such low magical density was incredibly impressive, especially for the time they did it. Only a fraction of what is now Old City had even been constructed. Even now, the important part, the dome, is more than capable of doing what we need. We just need to upgrade the control system so it can tell the dome to do it."
Clive turned to look at Rick.
"Your forebears were formidable people, Rick. You have every right to be proud of what your family has accomplished."
Rick nodded absently, glancing at the door.
"That legacy comes with a responsibility," he said morosely. "One we pay in blood to uphold."
Clive paused what he was doing to give Rick a long look.
"I've actually been here in the estate before," Clive said. "My first monster surge was the one before last, when I was a boy. My family members are eel farmers here in the Delta, and it was your family that took us in and sheltered us, along with countless others."
He walked over to Rick and put a hand on his shoulder.
"This is Greenstone," Clive said. "We know what the Gellername is worth. If you ever need anything, you ask. Everyone in the Delta knows that we've asked plenty, and your family answered every time."
Rick steeled his face to mask his emotions, and Clive gave him a big smile, patting his shoulder before leaving him be.
"Time to get started,"
Clive said, as he began pulling crates from his storage space. He left Belinda to organize them neatly and crack them open with a pry tool.
"You don't have a dimensional storage space,"
Clive said, looking at the small but effective crowbar.
"Where were you keeping that?"
"Tricks of the trade," Belinda said. "You always have to be ready."
"You're full of surprises, aren't you?"
"You have no idea."
After taking out the last box and leaving them to Belinda, Clive glanced back at Rick, then to the stone block.
"Now, Rick," Clive said, "you see that line running around the side of the stone block near the top?"
"Yeah," Rick said.
"That line is where the whole top section of the block comes off as a slab to access the inside. I'm going to unseal it, and I'll need you to lift that slab off and put it out of the way. Is that something you can manage?"
"That's a hefty bit of stone, but I'll sort it out," Rick said.
Clive used a magic wand to trace around the outside of the block, along the line he had just pointed out. Rick then hauled off the rune-covered top, revealing the block as a large stone box. The inside was covered in runes and fitted with different components. Stone tablets, also rune-covered, were slotted vertically into the bottom, as were crystals like sculpted icicles. Unlike the control panel, magical glows traced out lines and shone from the crystals, spraying rainbow colors into the room.
"Where are all the crystals?" Rick asked. "The ones you put in the side to add new monsters."
"Like this?"
Clive asked, taking out a crystal. It was a finger-sized length of faceted crystal.
"Yeah," Rick said. "I've seen a bunch of them put in."
"These are highly specialized, artificial manifestations of raw magic," Clive explained. "Sort of like very complicated spirit coins, if you like. When you feed them in the intake on the side, they vanish, like when you eat a spirit coin."
"So they don't just pile up inside then?" Rick asked.
"No, which is good. We'll need to add quite a few once the upgrade is up and working."
"How many is quite a few?"
4,096.
"Seriously?"
"Take a look at those crates," Clive said. "Most of them are filled with padded racks of crystals."
Clive took a simple table from his storage space, then draped a plain brown cloth over it. He laid out a series of magical tools, from wedge-shaped stones to crystal orbs with silver stands to stop them from rolling away. There was a slew of magic wands, varied in length, material, and shape. Many were curved or kinked. One was bent into a spiral halfway down its length. Clive got to work, explaining what he was doing to Belinda as he went.
"I'm going to wait outside," Rick said. "I'll be just out the door if you need anything."
"Thank you," Clive said absently, not looking up from his work. From where he was bent over into the stone box, he called on Belinda to hand him various tools. Belinda peppered him with questions as she handed him each new tool, peering in while he explained what he was doing at each step. One after another, the magical lights went out as he worked. Once the glow was completely faded, he started carefully removing parts. After setting them aside, he had Belinda hand him replacement parts from the boxes they had brought. He changed the runes inside the box, his tools reworking the hard stone like the softest clay. He slotted in new tablets and crystals, replacing almost everything inside. Finally, he chose a few of the components he had removed, and after checking them over, put them back into place. The discarded parts he had Belinda crate up for the Gellers to do with whatever they wanted. Finally, Clive began reactivating the magic of the control system, fastidiously testing his work carefully as the rainbow light once again started shining from within.
"This all looks good," Clive said. "I'll rework the control slab a bit, and we can do some final testing. Fetch Rick, would you please? I'll need him to reorient the slab as I work with it."
Clive modified both sides of the lid of the stone box, altering the Mirage Chamber controls. He had the lid replaced and started running tests on the Mirage Chamber functionality. They watched through the window as wild patterns lit up the space under the dome. There were several problems, requiring the slab to be taken off and put back on again multiple times as Clive made adjustments and tested again. Under the dome, on the other side of the viewing window, images flickered in and out. Monsters randomly appeared with odd colors or strangely warped bodies. The most bizarre was a Heidel with duck legs and both its heads being replaced with Rick's.
"Oh, that's not right," Rick said.
"You must use the chamber a lot if your head is the one that popped out," Clive said.
He methodically tackled each problem, testing and retesting as he worked through every incompatibility and adjusted every miscalibration. Finally, everything was in working order.
"Thank you," Clive said to Rick. "You've made this so much easier. Or possible at all, in fact. I doubt I could even move that lid, let alone lift it."
"My cousin would have loved this," Rick said, "getting into the guts of that thing."
"The expedition?"
Clive asked gently, and Rick nodded.
"Will this help us find the people who we fought there?" Rick asked.
"The ones who..." Rick's voice failed him as he remembered the blank look his friend had given him just hours ago.
"That's the idea," Clive said darkly. "We're looking for something that will let us hunt them down."
Rick nodded, eyes clear and focused. "What else can I do to help?"
"Grab that first crate of crystals," Clive said. "We have a lot to shove in there."
Chapter 19. Cleansed.
"That should be the nest in there," Humphrey said.
They were on a wide embankment road, running through a stretch of wetlands. The largest portion of high ground had a sizable stand of trees, in which they had been informed were the trap weavers. Humphrey and Sophie looked at Jason, who still had bags under his bloodshot eyes. His gaze focused on the trees, and Sophie noticed a shift in his posture. The confident, laconic half-slouch became more upright, his feet ready to move. There was a sudden readiness that her own instincts recognized as a preparedness to fight.
"Use a recording crystal," Humphrey said. "Give her something to watch later."
He nodded, taking out his carousel stand of recording crystals and picking one out before returning the carousel to his inventory. He tossed the crystal over his head, and his magical cloak formed around him. He ran to the edge of the embankment and leapt off, cloak floating around him, as he drifted lightly down to land on the surface of the water like it was solid ground. Moving forward, he disappeared into the trees.
"Objective,
eliminate trap weavers, 1 of 14.
That was quick, Sophie said.
Jason has abilities and equipment well suited to fighting trap weavers, Humphrey said. Most of us find them troubling at best and deadly at worst. More iron rankers in Greenstone die to trap weavers than anything else. Jason held his conjured dagger in a backhanded grip. Emerging from a shadow, he stabbed out to his side, pinning a spider to the tree it was gripping. The spider's body was around the size of a human torso, spewing out gore as the knife plunged through it. Objective: eliminate trap weavers, 2 of 14. You have defeated trap weaver. Would you like to loot trap weaver? Jason yanked the knife free, and the trap weaver splashed into the water. He walked over the surface of the water, unconcerned. Roots jutted from the water, but his perception power let him easily pick them out in the darkness. A thick strand of webbing shot out and latched onto his cloak, immediately trying to pull on it. That section of cloak became incorporeal, and the strand fell limp as Jason drew a throwing dart from the bandolier on his chest and flung it towards the other end of the strand. The dart had a red cord, marking it as explosive. Chunks of trap weaver belched out of the darkness with a loud bang. Objective: eliminate trap weavers, 3 of 14. Jason walked over to a gobbet of flesh that had struck a tree and poked it. You have defeated trap weaver. Would you like to loot trap weaver? One of the functions of Jason's hood was that he could see right through it without obstructing his vision. He could see trap weavers all around him, crawling on trees and believing themselves hidden in the dark. They were shades of grey, like Jason's armour, which had been crafted from their leather. Their legs ended in the sharp tips that dug into bark, which made them excellent tree climbers. Those legs were also powerful and springy, allowing them to leap between trees or onto prey. One of the spiders leapt at Jason from the left. He reached out and grabbed it out of the air, gripping it by the head. It bit into his hand as its sharp legs tried to stab his arm, but skittered off his armor. Trap weaver has inflicted trap weaver venom on you. You have resisted trap weaver venom. Trap weaver venom does not take effect. You have gained an instance of resistant. He crushed the spider's head in his fist and dropped it into the water. Objective: eliminate trap weavers, 4 of 14. You have defeated trap weaver. Would you like to loot trap weaver? From multiple directions, strands shot out at him. Some ineffectually struck his cloak, others slid off his armor without achieving purchase. Item: Trap Weaver Battle Robe. Iron Rank: Epic. A full body armor carefully handcrafted from the silk and leather of trap weavers. Armor: Cloth, Leather. Effect: Increased resistance to damage. Highly effective against cutting and piercing damage. Less effective against blunt damage. Effect: Repairs damage over time. Extensive damage may require external repair. Effect: Absorbs blood to prevent leaving a blood trail. Effect: Increases resistance to bleed and poison effects. Effect: Resistant to adhesive substances and abilities with adhesive effects. Effect: Adapts fit to the wearer within a certain range. Jason stood in the middle of the trap weaver encirclement. The monsters milled about, confused by their ineffectual attacks. In the shadowy copse of trees, Jason could teleport almost however he willed. He panned his gaze around, mapping out the shadows and the positions of the trap weavers. As the monsters launched a second barrage of webs, he vanished and went to work. Humphrey and Sophie awaited Jason's return. Objective: eliminate trap weavers, 5 of 14. Objective: eliminate trap weavers, 6 of 14. Objective: eliminate trap weavers, 7 of 14.
He really isn't messing about, Sophie said.
Everyone has their own way of fighting, Humphrey said. With most monsters, I have an easier time than Jason, but trap weavers are a bad match for me. I'm most effective against enemies that stand their ground in open space. Complex, shadowy environments are where trap weavers nest, but that's where Jason thrives. Over time, you'll come to find what works best for you. As you pick up more abilities and get more experience, you'll refine your style. Quest: Notice, Trap Weavers. Objective complete. Eliminate Trap Weavers. 14 of 14. Quest complete.
Sophie looked up, but no bag of coins appeared.
No rewards if we didn't contribute, Humphrey said. I can see the bag dropping on you becoming annoying.
Getting tired of money literally falling out of the sky is a problem I'll be happy to have.
They spotted rainbow smoke drifting up from the top of the trees as Jason emerged. Once he reached them, he dropped his cloak, revealing a large amount of blood on his head. The monster blood had vanished into smoke, making what remained come from his own injuries.
Are you all right? Humphrey asked.
No worries, Jason said. I healed up using my abilities.
Did one of them bite you on the head? Humphrey asked.
Yep, that was it.
What really happened? She asked.
Like Humphrey said, Jason told her, I got bitten by a monster.
I hope you won't be cutting me out of too many fights, Sophie said. I like getting paid. Not that it feels that way with you storing all the money.
Don't worry, Jason said. My storage space keeps all the money together, but I'm keeping track of how much is yours.
And I can trust you to keep the numbers straight, she asked.
You still don't trust me.
If our positions were swapped, she said, I would absolutely be stealing from you.
Jason chuckled.
You're his indentured servitor, Humphrey pointed out. All the work you do is for him, and he is entitled to take any or all of what you earn as he likes. He doesn't need to steal from you because he can take it all with complete legality. He doesn't have to do any more than feed you.
Don't worry, Jason said. I'll keep proper track. You have to pay for your own gear, though.
He took out a bottle of crystal wash and tipped it over his head.
That means both equipment and consumables, he added.
She gave him a flat look.
What? He asked her.
Why would you lie and claim you were bitten on the head? She asked.
I'm not lying, Jason said. I definitely didn't get woozy after the fight from teleporting too much while hungover and hit my head on a log.
The procession of people who entered the ritual room was as prestigious a gathering as to be found in Greenstone. Danielle Geller, Thalia Mercer, Elspeth Arella, Amir Bahadir, and the Archbishop of the Church of Purity, Nicholas Hendren. Ernest Geller was waiting inside, playing guard to Jonah Geller. Jonah, his upper arm firmly in Ernest's grip, glared at each person as they entered. When the Archbishop entered, Jonah's eyes went wide, and he strained to yank his arm free of Ernest's grasp. It didn't budge in the grip of Ernest's bronze rank strength. Elspeth Arella used her aura to brutally suppress Jonah's. Many powerful constriction abilities could only affect those whose auras had been beaten down, like the ability she used to entrap Jonah in a bubble of force. It cut off his protestations and lifted him helplessly into the air.
Thank you, Madam Director, the Archbishop said. If you could move him away from the center of the room, that would be appreciated.
Jonah's bubble floated away as his fists hammered at the inside. His mouth was visibly firing off invectives, but his voice was as confined as his body. The Archbishop took a white bag from the satchel at his side and removed the stopper from a spout in the bag's corner. From it, he started carefully pouring out a mixture of powdered silver and gold to form a ritual circle.
Fortunately, he said, divine rituals are not so vulnerable to vagaries of ambient magic as the mundane varieties.
I've never seen one performed before, Arella said.
They are much as ordinary rituals, the Archbishop said. They still draw on the power of ambient magic, but are infused with the glorious might of the divine. My god's will moves the magic, and not the other way around, which is why your ability in trapping the unfortunate boy will not affect it.
After drawing out the magical diagram, the Archbishop went around placing materials within it. Silver rank spirit coins were the bulk of the materials, while most of the others were orbs of gold or crystal, set out in small frames like silver egg cups. When he was done, he stepped back, held out a hand, and started chanting.
God most pure, I beseech, make in this place a sanctuary most clean, to suppress that which poisons the stem and reveal that which poisons the root. In this circle, let no rot spread nor foreign taint take action. Let all be made pure and clean.
White and gold light started shining up from the circle.
You may deposit the man in the circle, Madam Director,
the Archbishop said. The bubble floated towards the circle with Jonah, trapped inside, still furiously thrashing about. His hands and head were bloodied from where he had pounded them against the enclosure. As it entered the light, the bubble rapidly dissolved, like butter melting in the sun. Jonah fell out, but instead of collapsing to the floor, drifted through the air to float above the center of the magic circle. His arms and legs were pulled out to his sides, his whole body jerking in a small seizure. His eyes were wide and rapidly turning bloodshot, his jaw clenched tight.
Jonah,
Danielle whispered, her voice racked with misery as she looked on. Thalia Mercer placed a comforting hand on her shoulder, her own troubled gaze locked on the young man in the circle. Jonah's eyes rolled up in his head as his veins became visible as thin, dark lines all over his body.
There is no question,
the blank-faced Archbishop said impassively.
Something resides within the body. The circle will purge it.
The enemies in the astral space had something inside them,
Emiya said, looking at Danielle with concern.
When endangered, they were able to trigger it and kill themselves rather than be taken alive.
It is too late for that, the Archbishop said. Any power the thing inside him has cannot be activated within the circle. The concern you must have now is how deeply it has infiltrated his body. Removing it may damage or even kill him.
I have gold rank potions of the highest grade ready to go, Emiya told Danielle. So long as there is a scrap of life left in him, we won't let it fade.
I will heal him the moment I'm certain the taint is gone,
the Archbishop said. Danielle didn't acknowledge their words, her gaze unwavering from Jonah's struggles. His body's jerking became more violent, pushing back against the magic of the circle that held him in place. His eyes went bloody and dark, then burst outward, spraying dark fluids as something erupted from within them. Flailing metal wires, thin as hairs, shot out in clusters from his now empty eye sockets, waving like the tendrils of a sea creature. Danielle made to lunge forwards, but her arm was gripped by Emiya, his gold rank reflexes catching her before she moved. She turned on him in fury.
You cannot help him until it is done, the Archbishop said. I would suggest prayer.
Danielle shot the priest a look of venom before turning back to Jonah. She did so just in time for Jonah's cleansing to reach the final stage. Wires burst out from every part of his body, shredding muscle and skin, slicing apart bones. His flesh was shredded just as badly as his clothes as they erupted out of him. The wires formed a complex network that seemed to have threaded itself through his entire circulatory system. A whole nest of wires had riddled Jonah's brain, slicing his skull into pieces that tumbled to the ground with the rest of his shredded corpse. What was left was a vaguely man-shaped wire figure, with all the wires threading into and out of a nucleus in the place of the heart. Free of Jonah's body, the mass of wires staggered forward, but was rapidly corroded by exposure to the light of the circle. The wires dissolved into nothing as the nucleus fell to the floor with a hollow clatter. In the aftermath, the light faded from the now bloody circle. What had once been Jonah was splattered over the circle. All that remained of the wire construct was the empty nucleus. It looked like a small, hulled coconut. Danielle didn't spare it a glance as she staggered forwards towards the gory mess that was all that remained of Jonah.
It's done,
the Archbishop said, his emotionless intonation startling everyone but Danielle into looking at his calm expression. Emiya and Thalia turned to Danielle, who mercifully didn't seem to have heard. She stood in front of Jonah's bloody remains, no longer recognizable as a person. Chapter 20. It just takes practice. In the late afternoon, Humphrey, Sophie, and Jason were walking down a road with tall, leafy crops to either side. Finally starting to feel better, Jason let his head fall back as he drew a deep breath. He felt the warm sun of early autumn, smelled the fresh, earthy scent of the crops. He let out a contented sigh.
"This is it," he said, happily.
"People talk about the money and the power, but this is the adventuring life I want. Meandering through beautiful places with a good friend and a beautiful woman who may or may not be waiting for the chance to snap my neck and run for it."
"Really?"
Sophie asked, flatly. Humphrey shook his head.
"I said may not. Just look around you. Breathe in that air. Tell me you don't want to spend your life traveling the world and visiting nice places."
Sophie did look around, skeptically at first, then compared it to the boxed-in streets of Old City, the open spaces, the peaceful breeze playing through leafy crops.
"It does smell a lot nicer than Old City," she acknowledged.
"Money and power are great," Jason said. "Anything you want to get, they can give you. Anything you want to do, they can let you. But you have to want things worth having and want to do things worth doing. Money and power have to be a means, not an end, or you'll lead a joyless life." Jason looked around the landscape again.
"Freedom. Travel. I want to see what this world has to show me. And someday, I want to go home, to see my own world with new eyes."
Sophie said nothing, giving Jason an assessing look.
"What?"
he asked.
"Nothing," she said. "You're just not what I expected."
"And what were you expecting?"
"I don't know," she said. "Not this."
"What's your world like, Jason?" Humphrey asked. "It has places like this," Jason said. "My family used to take trips out into the country when I was younger. My mother has a large family of mostly rural types. Good, hard-working people, you know? Not all twisty in the head like me. I grew up in a sleepy little beach town. In summer, it fills up with people. Later, I moved to a big city, although nothing like Greenstone. I'm not sure how to even start describing it. I wasn't happy there, but I don't think I was trying to be then." He flashed a grin.
"But now I'm here. I have money, magic powers, and I'm walking around in a place like this on a day like today. Yes, monsters try to kill me a lot, and I've made my share of enemies, but I'm living my life now, instead of just waiting it out."
"Speaking of monsters," Humphrey said, "the contract is for Margols, dog-headed humanoids with large claws. They should be a good matchup for you, Miss Wexler, but don't underestimate them." "They're highly aggressive and fight in packs," Jason said. "You'll be outnumbered. The contract says 6, but you should never assume the details are accurate."
"That's an important lesson," Humphrey said. "A couple of months ago, Jason and I went to retrieve the body of an adventurer killed because the contract details were wrong."
"Very wrong," Jason said. "We were lucky someone else didn't end up coming for our bodies."
"Margols are another common local monster," Humphrey said. "When they turn up, everyone evacuates and word is sent to the city to post a contract. There are several farms here, so they've probably settled in until they eat their way through the herds. Once Stash spots them, we'll have a location."
"Stash?" Sophie asked.
"That's the bird familiar you've had scouting around."
"He's been spending a lot of time as a bird lately," Humphrey said. "I'm not sure how much he understands about what happened during the expedition, but he knows there was a lot of danger. I think he's trying to be more useful."
"Spending time as a bird?" Sophie asked.
Humphrey was about to answer when a large bird swooped out of the sky towards Humphrey, transforming into a puppy and dropping into his arms. Humphrey scratched him behind the ears.
"He's a shape changer," Humphrey said.
"You found them, little guy?" Stash yipped happily. By turning his head and letting out little barks, Stash led them in the right direction. Eventually, they spotted the Margols in a field full of dead animals. The three crouched in the long grass, behind a simple wooden rail fence that separated the field from the road. They looked through the fence at the Margols on the far side of the field.
"Looks like the Margols came from this side," Humphrey said. The herd fled to the far end of the field and were pinned against the fence and slaughtered. The slain herd were creatures that Jason had always thought of as cow lizards, never able to recall their proper name. The Margols had killed them all and were feasting on the carcasses. "Those poor animals," Humphrey said. "I know they were a meat herd, but they didn't need to die in fear like that. And it's wasteful, too. The Margols can't consume all that meat, but they only eat their fresh kills. They'll take their fill, sleep it off, and go hunting for more things to slaughter." "No, they won't," Jason said. "They aren't leaving this field." "I count 9.
"Me too," Sophie said.
"Wexler, Humphrey will be ready to step in quickly if anything goes wrong. You need to understand, though, that when things go wrong, they go wrong fast and hard. I'm not saying don't take risks, because pushing yourself is the point. Just make sure they're calculated risks." Sophie took a steeling breath, then lightly vaulted the wooden fence and started walking across the field. Caught up in gorging on the dead animals, the Margols didn't notice her until a breeze picked up and carried her scent to them. As it did, they looked up from their kills and howled. Leaping to their feet, they started charging across the field at her. She stopped, watching them approach. Dog-headed monsters with sickle claws scrambled madly in her direction, some on 2 limbs, others on 4. She started moving again, picking up her pace to run at them as they charged in her direction, letting out discordant, bloodthirsty howls. They were quick, but she sailed over the grass like a wind spirit. Well short of reaching them, she leapt into the air. She spun through one horizontal kick and then into a second with the other leg, both without touching the ground. Then she stepped on the air to keep her momentum going and kicked once more before finally landing. She had made 2 full turns in the air and landed at a run. Each sweeping kick had unleashed a wide blade of wind that made a shimmering path towards the Margols. The trio of wide blades were as large and slow as she could make them, but the ravening monsters disregarded their approach entirely. The change came as the first blade savaged the foremost monsters, blood spraying as they ran right into the blade. It was not enough to kill them, but 2 fell to the ground, howling distress. The one who stayed standing took the full brunt of the second blade, its body cut into ragged halves, while more of the creatures were injured behind it. The 3rd blade came on the heels of the 2nd, finishing the wounded Margols and injuring more. The pack were left angry, hurt, and confused. The injured ones howled their pain, the others their rage. Their charge had been halted as they milled in disarray. Back on the road, Jason and Humphrey looked on using a far-sight crystal to magnify their view.
"Did you know she could do that?" Humphrey asked.
"I did not," Jason replied. "Should we move closer?"
"I think so," Humphrey said.
Wings appeared on his back and he flew over the fence. Jason vaulted it, not with the grace Sophie had done, but Gary's mobility training made it a negligible task.
"How long would it take you to get over there?" Jason asked.
"A few seconds," Humphrey said. 5, maybe." "You can cross the distance that quick?"
"If I fly forward, then launch into my flying leap attack, yes."
"Not bad." The Margols were in turmoil, and Sophie was not going to waste it, still running across the grass as if she were flying. She crashed into one of the injured ones, knocking it into the rest and adding to the chaos her wind blades had sown. The Margols fought with wild ferocity, while her movements were clean and efficient. Blocks made openings for attack, and dodges set up combination strikes. Fists and feet, elbows and knees. No movement was wasted or opportunity missed as she pounded the Margols with power and precision. Despite her speed and skill, the frenetic creatures were not on the back foot for long, using their numbers to box in their sole enemy. Sickle claws aimed to reap her life away, but were met with fists and forearms. Every attack she was able to meet, her powers shielded her from suffering so much as a scratch. As they moved to surround her, she couldn't intercept every attack. A raking slash from the side cut into her leg, and from the rear, a lacerating swipe scored her upper arm. She ignored the pain and kept fighting. She had drawn them in as she wanted. Having boxed her in, the monsters pushed hard, only to find she had been replaced with an afterimage. As their claws lashed ineffectually through it, she reappeared a small distance away. The clustered Margols milled in confusion, but Sophie was launching another triple wind blade. As they had moved so close together in their attempt to overwhelm her, the Margols had made themselves vulnerable to the sweeping blades of air. The razor wind erupted on impact after slicing through skin and muscle, the blade hideously effective against the Margols, who had no more defences than their short, bristly fur. After three blades, only one remained standing, badly injured. Sophie finished it off before making sure the ones on the ground were all dead. Surrounded by dead enemies, Sophie stood tall and drew in heavy, exhausted breaths. Jason and Humphrey arrived at the scene as a bag of coins fell on her head.
Ow.
When did you come up with that spinning jump thing? Jason asked her.
You left for 2 weeks, she said, picking up the bag. Did you think I spent the whole time meditating?
Fair enough, he said, taking the bag and putting it in his inventory. Did Rufus help you with that?
I think he felt bad for me.
Sorry, Jason said. I kind of left you in limbo there. Jason took out a notebook and scribbled in it with a pencil.
What's that?
Sophie asked. It's how I'm keeping track of your money, he said, putting them away again.
Oh, she said. Thank you.
You have some real unarmed combat skills, Humphrey said. I have a relative, Phoebe. She's an unarmed specialist too, and she's been looking for someone to practice with for a while. I think you could help each other.
I'd like that, Sophie said, jerking a thumb at Jason. She has to be more reliable than this guy.
Oh, come on, Jason said.
You did just leave without telling anyone, Humphrey pointed out.
Yeah, well, all right, that's fair.
If you're interested, then sooner might be better than later, Humphrey said. It would be dark long before we reach the city. My family estate is closer, here in the Delta. I can introduce you to Phoebe and we can go back to the city in the morning.
Sounds good to me, Jason said. What do you say, Wexler? Want to be put up in the most prestigious estate in Greenstone? I'll just loot these monsters and we can get going.
You realize you're saying that to someone staying in Emir Bahadir's cloud palace, Humphrey said.
I'm going to miss having a cloud bed, Jason said. It was the worst part of leaving the city for so long.
I can't offer those, Humphrey said. But we do have hammocks. They're really good for the hot nights.
Never have sex in a hammock, Jason advised. It seems like it would be awesome, but it's actually quite troublesome.
It just takes practice,
Humphrey said offhandedly, earning a wide-eyed look from Jason.
What?
Humphrey asked.
What are we looking at?
Rick asked. In the Mirage Chamber control room, Rick, Belinda, and Clive were looking through the window. Under the dome, a large illusionary orb and a small illusionary orb were pressing into one another.
The small orb is a simulated astral space, Clive said. The big orb is a simulated world it's attached to. This isn't what they would actually look like. I simulated their magical aspects rather than the physical ones.
Why? Rick asked.
A lot of equipment was brought back from the astral space, Clive explained. I managed to replicate what they were doing on a small scale, but I couldn't figure out what it did. Using it in our world instead of an astral space meant all the power it output just got absorbed. Our world is too big. Of course, going back into the astral space and setting it up again was not an option. Here, we've created a simulation of an astral space, a world to anchor it, and the equipment the expedition bought operating inside it.
So instead of a monster, you've created a whole world? Rick asked.
Not exactly, Clive said. I've examined the equipment quite thoroughly and isolated what it should interact with and simulated that. Simulating a whole world is beyond any Mirage Chamber I've ever heard of.
So, what are the results? Rick asked.
We'll have to wait. I've accelerated the simulation as much as possible, and so long as I haven't missed anything major, it will eventually show us exactly what the expedition interrupted.
They watched eagerly for the first hour, attention waning by the second. Rick left and brought back lunch, while Clive and Belinda turned to books from Clive's personal stash. After looking through Clive's collection, Rick went to retrieve a book with less theory and more tales of dashing heroics. It was evening before something changed inside the chamber. They all went to the window to watch the two orbs that had finally become more active.
We already know what they were doing would have catastrophic results,
Clive said. The major question is whether that was the objective or a side effect. The two orbs had been pushing into each other for the entire run of the simulation, but as they watched, the smaller orb pulled away. The surface of the large orb, where the small orb had contacted it, was wrinkled and marred, where the rest was smooth.
Is that it? Rick asked.
No, Clive said. The astral space, the small orb, shouldn't be able to maintain its integrity without being attached to its world. Just pulling apart should have caused it to break down.
Is someone trying to make a small, independent world?
Belinda asked.
If they are, it won't work, Clive said. It can't last long like that.
As if to prove his point, the smaller orb started to distort, breaking into chunks and then vanishing entirely.
There we have it, Clive said.
Their objective was to separate the astral space from our world while maintaining its structure for at least some amount of time.
How much time? Belinda asked.
Weeks, months at the outside. I'll need to examine the simulation recording to get more details, but the basics are clear.
Why would they do that? Rick asked.
No idea, Clive said.
Who benefits? Belinda asked. And how?
Who benefits from a huge chunk of dislodged physical reality floating through the deep astral? Clive asked. No one. Even gods couldn't do anything with it. Once it leaves their world, it's out of their ability to affect. All that leaves is...
Clive's eyes went wide as he let out a low sound of horror.
No.
He paced back and forth, clutching at his hair with his hands.
This is bigger than us, he said. Astral spaces. Ours wasn't the only one affected. Oh, this is bad.
What's bad?
Belinda asked. She and Rick were looking at Clive in frustration.
I figured it out, he said.
We got that much, Belinda said. What did you figure out?
We need to tell someone, Clive said. A diamond ranker. Lots of diamond rankers.
He bolted for the door, Belinda and Rick following, only to meet Clive rushing back in. He gave Rick a look of wild-eyed panic.
I don't know how to get back to the main house.
Chapter 21 World Building. The sky was nearing full dark, but the pathways of the Geller estate were lit up by magical lights, albeit one selected and placed more for aesthetics than practicality. Rather than simple illumination, the discreetly placed lights washed the gardens in shifting colours. Clive had no time to stop and appreciate it, as he led Rick and Belinda through the gardens in a rush, striding with his long legs. Belinda did have time. Clive's enthusiasm outpaced his ability to navigate, requiring Rick to correct him as he headed down one wrong path after another. This allowed Belinda to keep up in spite of her more measured pace.
I like these lights, Belinda said.
Good, aren't they? Rick asked.
No, Clive, to the left.
Clive grumbled as he came back up one path to head down another.
Explain this again, Belinda said to Clive as he came past. There's some kind of super god.
Yes, Clive said distractedly. Except, no. But yes. But no.
That clears everything up, Rick said, as Clive strode off again.
Compared to Clive, Humphrey, Sophie, and Jason made their way through estate grounds at a relaxed saunter. They took the time to appreciate the colourfully lit paths.
I looted some material from those trap weavers, Jason said. My combat robes are made from the same stuff. I know a guy who can probably use it to make you something similar, Wexler.
I thought you said I'd have to pay for my own gear,
Sophie said.
We're in a group, Jason said. We split the loot as a group. You'll still have to pay for labor costs yourself.
Thanks, she said with a frown. Sorry, that sounded insincere. Gratitude isn't a feeling I'm used to.
Jason laughed.
No worries. I know what it feels like to go from random nobody to adventurer with magic powers and such, hobnobbing with the wealthy and powerful. Which will be us, soon enough. It's a bit disorienting, isn't it? Feels hard to get your feet under you. Normal keeps slipping away from you like a bar of wet soap. You're constantly trying to figure out what normal is now.
Yeah, she said.
That's exactly what it feels like.
Danielle, Emir, Thalia, Arella, and the Archbishop were moving through the estate grounds from the ritual building towards the main house. Fresh from witnessing the gruesome demise of Jonah Geller, Danielle was still reeling, lingering at the back of the group. Ernest Geller, the only non-silver amongst them, had taken over the duty of guiding them through the grounds.
"I'm not subjecting my son to that process,"
Thalia Mercer said adamantly as they moved along the path.
"That will not be necessary," said Hendren, the Archbishop of Purity. "Now that we know what we are dealing with, our methods can be more precise."
"We know what we're dealing with?" Arella asked.
"The boy was implanted with a star seed. My church has seen such things in the past, and has long developed the means to extract them. There will be damage, depending on how long the seed has been inside them, but no irrevocable harm."
"What good does that do, Jonah?"
Danielle spat. It was the first time she had spoken since Emir led her away from Jonah's ruined body.
"What is this star seed exactly?" Emir asked.
"They are the creations of entities from beyond your physical reality, only existing in the deep astral," the Archbishop said. "They are known by various names, but most commonly as the great astral beings. There are heretics in our world who offer them improper veneration, perversely akin to how the pious worship the gods. The astral beings can bestow blessings like gods, but cannot bestow essence and awakening stones. Instead, they can send their followers star seeds."
"Is that what the people we tried to capture were using to kill themselves?"
Emir asked.
"Most likely," the Archbishop said. "The seed must first be implanted into the body. Once it has germinated, the body undergoes a transformation, which may be minor or major."
"We've seen that," Thalia said. "The people who attacked the expedition were bizarre combinations of flesh and steel."
"Once the transformation is complete, the remnant power of the star seed is available for the heretic to use. Exploding that power to kill themselves should be well within their capabilities."
"And they put those things in our children," Thalia growled. "I'm going to kill them all."
"And so you should," the Archbishop said. "The seeds turn the implanted people into vessels for the astral beings, puppets without will. Only the most dedicated volunteer for such a process. At first, the influence is subtle, their memories and personalities remaining intact, the only control being a drive to protect the seeds within them from discovery. Slowly, without their even realizing it is happening, the hosts become puppets. Their personalities are supplanted, shifting towards the will of the astral being who crafted the seeds."
"How long does that take?" Thalia asked.
"I don't know," the Archbishop said. "I only know this much because I have studied all manner and means of impurity. I have never encountered a star seed in person. I will consult my church's records after returning to the city."
"Why weren't these seeds found before now?" Thalia asked. "All five were examined in the camp, then back in the city, by silver rank healers. Why didn't they find these things inside them?"
"Star seeds are not some affliction to be easily purged by an essence ability," the Archbishop explained. "These are transcendent rank objects brought into being by entities so vast and alien that we cannot comprehend the fullness of them. They require more than some simple ritual or essence ability to discover, let alone purge. We should give thanks to our gods for shielding us from such things."
"Your god didn't help Jonah," Danielle said. "Your god's ritual tore him apart."
"Perhaps if your family were more dedicated in their piety, he would have been protected."
Emir used a mirage step to get between Danielle and the Archbishop, holding out a hand to forestall her rage. The whole group stopped.
After checking she wasn't going to rush past him, Emir turned a fierce glare on the priest.
You had best watch yourself, Archbishop, Emir warned. Keep talking like that, and I won't get in her way again.
The Archbishop snorted derision, but didn't say anything else, resuming his passage through the gardens. After a heavy pause, the others followed.
The next step must be to retrieve the other four, Arella said as they neared the main house. You are certain you can extract these seeds without harming the people they are implanted in?
Without harming?
No.
Without killing?
Yes.
I am certain my church has the means, although there are two requirements. First, we must get hold of the people that harbor them before the seeds have taken too deep a root. Once the seeds have overtaken the body, they impinge upon the soul, after which it is too late. The second requirement is that we need to know which astral entity created the seeds. Each such entity creates a different seed and must be adjusted for accordingly.
That gives us two priorities then, Arella said. First, retrieve the remaining four affected, which should be the easy part. The Adventure Society has people watching them, waiting on the results of this ritual. Now we are certain they've been compromised, we can have them brought in immediately. They will be apprehended, and Mr. Baradia's portal user can bring them back to Greenstone. What about finding out which great astral being we're dealing with? Daniel asked. I want to know who is doing this to us.
I can answer that, a voice called out. They were nearing the main house, where the pathways leading all through the estate converged into an open space. Coming from another path was an agitated Clive, with Rick and Belinda in tow. Rick cast an anxious gaze over the group. He saw that Jonah was not with them, while Ernest, who he had last seen guarding Jonah, was. Then he spotted Danielle, red-eyed and distraught, which startled him. He had never seen her in any state but complete self-control. Rick's whole body slumped as he realized what that meant for Jonah's fate.
What are you talking about?
Arella asked as Clive hurried to them.
You were talking about an astral entity, right?
Clive asked.
I know which one it is and what it's after.
The two groups converged as Rick and Belinda followed, then grew again as Humphrey, Jason, and Sophie appeared. Belinda and Sophie shared a surprised look at each other's presence, while Humphrey was startled by his mother's plain distress, rushing to her side. His large figure towered over her as he embraced her in a deep hug.
I think perhaps, Arella said, we should take any further discussion inside.
She turned to Ernest.
You were part of the group that found the five, yes?
She asked.
I was, Ernest said.
I assume there is a speaking chamber here on the estate. The personal autonomy of the other four is no longer valid. Tell the rest of your group to take the remaining four into custody immediately and bring them in, under the full authority of the Adventure Society.
Yes, ma'am, Ernest said, before moving off at a half run.
We have a conference room in the house,
Danielle said, giving Humphrey's arm a reassuring pat as she moved out of his embrace.
We can hear out Mr. Standish there. Humphrey, please see to the rest of our guests.
Danielle led the group inside the house, leaving Humphrey with Jason, Belinda, Sophie, and Rick.
What are you doing here, Lindy?
Sophie asked.
Complicated magic with the fate of the world at stake,
Belinda said, casually.
You?
It's getting late and I was offered a hammock.
My thing is more exciting,
Belinda said.
Sounds like it.
Who were all those people?
Just a bunch of rich folk,
Belinda said.
So, a hammock. Do you remember that guy Barry? He always used to sleep in a hammock.
Was he the one that got killed when an anvil fell on him?
That's the one. Building a smithy on the third floor was a terrible idea.
I recall a lot of his ideas being bad.
No kidding.
He wanted to, you know, in his hammock one time. I thought it would be fun, but it was just awkward.
I'm told it takes practice, Sophie said.
Of course you were told that,
Belinda said.
Anyone who looks at you, their first thought is, how to get that girl to practice sex with me a lot.
That's how we got into this whole mess, remember?
That's not how I'd describe it.
As the two women talked, Humphrey and Jason approached Rick, staring blankly into the air.
Rick?
Humphrey asked.
I don't think Jonah made it,
Rick said absently, eyes unfocused.
He's dead?
Humphrey asked.
They didn't say, but you saw your mother.
Humphrey bowed his head, running his hands through it.
God's damn it! I didn't know things were that bad.
Ernest brought him in by portal, Rick said. They had me waiting to go get all the...
He waved his arm at the house, where all the important people had gone, leaving them behind.
Where was that?
Humphrey asked.
The ritual room. The big, isolated one.
Well, let's go take a look, Humphrey said. See if we can't get some answers.
Humphrey pointed out a building annexed from the main house.
That's one of the visitor residences, he said.
Jason, you, Miss Wexler, and her friend can go straight in. Jason nodded, patting Rick on the shoulder.
Let me know about Jonah, yeah?
Of course.
Clive was pacing at the end of a conference room, while the group of Greenstone's most important people sat around the long, rectangular table. The decor was typical of the Geller estate, with light woods and artfully woven reeds offering pleasant airflow and relying on unseen magic to provide the privacy.
How did you know one of the great astral beings was involved?
Clive asked.
You are here to answer our questions, the Archbishop said. Not the other way around.
Right, yes. So, great astral beings. We don't know all that much about most of them, because only a handful seem to take any interest in physical realities. The World Phoenix, the All-Devouring Eye, the Reaper, the Celestial Book. More than any of those, however, one called the Builder takes specific interest in physical realities.
You seem well-versed in the knowledge of these beings, the Archbishop said.
Yes, Clive said. I happen to venerate the Celestial Book myself. It's fairly common for those of us heavily involved in magical theory.
You admit to being a heretic?
The Archbishop asked, half standing. The rage on his face was a stark contrast to the emotionless way he had observed Jonah's horrific death. Clive glared back at the Archbishop.
I suppose I could be considered a heretic, Clive said, the same way that the exploitation of rigid dogma to act out personal prejudice could be considered faith.
The Archbishop's silver rank aura exploded towards Clive, but was immediately crushed by Emir's gold rank aura.
This is not the time, Archbishop. We are here to listen, not judge.
The gods are always judging us. Forgoing righteousness for expediency is an easy path to sin.
And not shutting up is the path to being kicked out, Danielle said. This is my home, and you are here by my forbearance.
The Archbishop scowled, but settled silently back into his seat.
Emotions are running high, and with good reason, Emir said. That doesn't change the fact that tempering ourselves will accomplish more than indulging ourselves will.
Emir panned his gaze around the room, asserting his authority with a delicate but unmistakable employment of his aura.
Please, continue, Mr. Standish, he said.
Thank you, Clive said. As I was saying, there is one astral entity who takes more interest than the other in physical realities, which is to say, worlds like ours. Most of the others operate similarly to gods, in that what they want is the promotion of various ideals. The World Phoenix fosters dimensional integrity. The Celestial Book promotes the understanding of magic's underlying nature. The Reaper advocates the finality of death. The Builder is not like these others. It has no interest in disseminating principles and is instead obsessed with physical reality, while, by its very nature, being unable to coexist with it. This dichotomy of its core drive and its intrinsic properties has led to an undertaking on such ambition it staggers belief.
What kind of undertaking? Emir asked.
It's building a world of its own,
Clive said, creating a new physical reality in the deep astral. The way it does this is to take raw materials that are neither fully of the astral or of physical reality.
You're talking about astral spaces, Arella said.
Exactly, Clive said. Astral spaces form attached to worlds, without which they immediately break down. Without a real world to anchor them, they cannot exist. But if an astral space is given the ability to sustain itself, even for just a brief period, the builder can take it and anchor it to the world the builder is creating from stolen parts.
You're saying that those people we fought were trying to steal the astral space for this builder? Arella asked. A dimensional pirate? Plundering chunks of reality from which to build its own?
That is exactly what I'm saying. An astral being cannot interact with physical reality directly, so it needs to recruit others to act for it. The builder recruits people to carve off the astral spaces connected to their world, then it steps in and claims them. I've read about the builder doing this, but now I've seen the means by which it does so.
What are the ramifications of losing astral spaces? Emiya asked.
It varies, since different astral spaces are connected to worlds in different ways. The process they were using in our local astral space was designed to keep the astral space intact, at the cost of catastrophic destruction to the physical reality. I can confidently assert that the results would be similar in other instances.
We have reports of astral spaces suffering incursions like ours all over the world, Arella said.
That's right, Clive said. Astral spaces all over the world. We're talking about cataclysmic destruction the world over, death and destruction on a civilization-ending scale. The only comfort I can take is that there are smarter people than me looking into all this, and stronger people than us doing something about it. This is a threat that extends beyond the reaches of our world. We need diamond rankers to act, and act fast.
Don't sell yourself short, Mr. Standish, Emiya said. The information you're giving us is not information we've been getting from elsewhere. Either they don't know or they are hiding the potential risks to avoid panic.
At the risk of agreeing with the Archbishop, Thalia Mercer said, how confident are you in this information, Standish?
Very, Clive said. My knowledge of the great astral beings comes from one of the Magic Society's previous directors. The great astral beings were his field of study, and he had a collection of journals from diamond rank adventurers who had travelled between worlds. He left those to me after his death, and I know them well.
And you're sure this builder's people are the ones doing these things to our astral spaces? Thalia asked.
Yes. The builder, as I mentioned, has no driving ideology. He forms groups, cults, driven not by ideology, but through gifts of power. The fact that we are seeing any of this suggests they have been operating here for years, maybe decades.
But you are certain this builder is behind them? Arella asked.
I have managed to successfully simulate what they were doing in the Geller's Mirage Chamber. The goal of their efforts was to reinforce the astral space and sever it from our world. Nothing short of a great astral being has the power to make anything of such an act, and of them, only the builder has any interest in it.
I think our next move should be to confirm this information as best we can, Arella said. If we combine what we've seen today, Mr. Standish's findings, and the experiences of the expedition together, we may well have at least an acceptable level of confirmation to disseminate to the Adventure Society at large.
Mr. Standish, I'd like a look at those journals, if you don't mind, Emiya requested.
I've made copies of the originals, Clive said. I'll deliver them to your Cloud Palace.
I shall look into the records of our rituals for removing star seeds, the Archbishop said. There may be details in the rituals for removing this builder's seeds that help confirm he is the one.
Thank you, Emiya said.
I'll turn the more scholarly members of my family loose on the Temple of Knowledge's library, Danielle said. The goddess always welcomes seekers of truth.
I'll do likewise, Thalia said.
I will make sure that everything we learn is spread to the Adventure Society as a whole, and see if they have anything in return, Arella said. We aren't the only ones dealing with this problem, but one group of many working to contribute.
Good, Emir said, standing up. We all have our tasks. We should get to them. Well done, Mr. Standish.
The hour is getting late, Danielle said, also getting up. You are all welcome to stay the night. We have ample room.
Thalia and Emir accepted the offer, with the Archbishop and Elspeth Arella declining. Everyone recognized that neither the priest nor the Adventure Society director were truly welcome in Danielle Geller's home. They went off to their transport, while Danielle led Thalia, Emir, and Clive towards the guest wing.
Mr. Standish, Emir said, as they left the conference room. Have you ever considered becoming a professional treasure hunter?
Chapter 22 Fabulous Prizes. The day's first light found Jason meditating on a porch. It was attached to just one of the Geller family guest houses, each larger than the four-bedroom home Jason grew up in. Like most of the Geller estate building, it was nestled amongst the lush greenery of the gardens.
Ability, Cloak of Night, Dark, has reached Iron 6, 100%. Ability, Cloak of Night, Dark, has reached Iron 7, 00%.
Jason opened his eyes. His recent 2-week storm of monster hunting had not been as effective at raising his abilities as he hoped. His lower-level abilities improved well enough, but his highest-rank ones were starting to plateau. Once he was back in the city, he would seek out Rufus for advice.
Jason Asano, Race, Outworlder, Current Rank, Iron, Progression to Bronze Rank, 25%, Attributes, Power, Blood, Iron, 5, Speed, Dark, Iron 0, Spirit, Doom, Iron 0, Recovery, Sin, Iron 5. Racial Abilities, Outworlder, Party Interface, Quest System, Inventory, Map, Astral Affinity, Mysterious Stranger, Essences, 4 of 4, Dark, Speed, 3 of 5, Midnight Eyes, Special Ability, Iron, 8, 19%, Cloak of Night, Special Ability, Iron, 7, 00%. Path of Shadows, Special Ability, Iron, 7, 04%. Blood, Power, 5 of 5. Blood Harvest, Spell, Iron, 6, 98%. Leech Bite, Special Attack, Iron, 6, 14%. Feast of Blood, Spell, Iron, 5, 92%. Sanguine Horror, Familiar, Iron, 6, 89%. Hemorrhage, Spell, Iron 5, 06%. Sin, Recovery, 5 of 5. Punish, Special Attack, Iron 7, 23%. Feast of Absolution, Spell, Iron 6, 23%. Sin Eater, Special Ability, Iron 6, 69%. Hegemony, Aura, Iron 7, 69%. Castigate, Spell, Iron 5, 23%. Doom, Spirit, 4 of 5. Inexorable Doom, Spell, Iron 7, 16%. Punition, Spell, Iron 6, 54%. Blade of Doom, Spell, Iron 4, 39%. Verdict, Spell, Iron 3, 94%.
Jason could feel the change.